Hello, my name is Yang Kwan. I'm a columnist for the Diplomat magazine and co-editor of the North Korea research blog, Rice and Iron. I'll be guest hosting this episode of Worldwise on Blogging Heads TV, and I'm here today with Stephen Denny. Stephen is currently the managing editor of the research site SinoNK and a doctoral student at the University of Toronto, focusing his research on comparative politics, Korean domestic politics, and modern Korean nationalism. He was previously the editor-in-chief of the Yonsei Journal of International Studies and worked at the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in South Korea. Glad to have you here today, Stephen. Is there anything I missed in your recent research?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. Very excited to embark upon discussion with you today. Maybe the only thing I would add is that recently a cohort from SinoNK, Dr. Adam Cathcart, Christopher Green, and myself recently made a research trip funded by the Academy of Korean Studies to the three provinces of Northeast China. But we can talk more about that in a bit, if you want.
Yes, definitely. That will definitely be something that we'll want to discuss your experiences there. I guess to start, for American audiences, the most recent news from Northeast Asia was probably the reinterpretation of Article 9, the Japanese Constitution, providing Tokyo with the power to deploy forces abroad, a measure that was met with great protests from South Korea and China. But even before this measure was pushed through in the Japanese government, Seoul and Beijing had been collaborating heavily on condemning Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's revisionist attitudes towards the history of the Second World War. And even though this issue was not explicitly mentioned in the joint statement during Xi Jinping's official state visit to South Korea earlier in July, both China and South Korea have vociferously forwarded issues such as Japan's biological experiments on living subjects in Unit 731, the issue with Korean sex slaves in the Japanese Imperial Army, and Japanese war crimes in general during the war. This raises the question of whether the warming relationship between Beijing and Seoul suggests that ideas and historical narratives play a larger role in international relations than objective calculations of national interest, or at least in the Northeast Asia region. Could you speak on this issue, on this topic?
Yeah, I can. The question as to whether historical narratives play a larger role in international relations than objective calculations of national interest is certainly an open question. But I think that, let's say, a basic, a conventional realist approach probably does the best job in explaining why states act the way they do. But a common casualty of that approach is sort of overlooking some of these ideational issues. And these ideational issues certainly have an impact on the policymaking process, foreign and domestic. The one example that comes to mind first is the information sharing agreement that was agreed upon between South Korea and Japan that was aborted just hours before it was to be signed by the South Korean administration at the behest of the party, which asked for a delay so that it could be discussed at a forthcoming convening of the members in parliament. And the reason cited for actually delaying it was, one, that the parties were quite upset, and two, that the public was upset that, you know, how dare South Korea sign an information sharing agreement? And this is information regarding military issues, not classified material or high priority material, but basic information sharing. But they were worried that the public would feel, you know, quite ill that South Korea would be willing to sign an agreement with Japan, with whom they feel is not acting quite appropriately right now. So I think, you know, that's an example of this ideational issue actually affecting the policymaking process. But insofar as we're concerned with explaining behavior over time of states, I think you're going to see the objective calculations of national interest having much a higher explanatory power.
Right. And just to be clear, the protests were mostly on the Korean side, right? There weren't any Japanese protests on this information sharing agreement between Seoul and Tokyo, correct?
Yeah. Don't cite me on this, but I'm quite sure that, I mean, it was South Korea who aborted signing the deal. I think had they not aborted this, it would have been concluded. Both the Japanese were anticipating it, and South Korea had signaled its intent to do it, and then they backed out because of what was cited as popular backlash, civic groups and activists who were upset at what South Korea was doing.
Right. You mentioned earlier your research trip to Manchuria. And that's one area, one region in Northeast Asia that's very interesting because it plays a very large role in the shared narrative, the current shared narrative between China and South Korea in their opposition to Japan's foreign policy. You wrote significantly on China and South Korea's shared narrative in Manchuria. Could you discuss some of the details of this conflict over historical narrative? And I know you mentioned that the objective calculations of national interest do dominate over the ideational aspects, but in many cases. But could you explain perhaps the historical narrative and how it's affecting national relations in the region at the moment, in particular regards to the events in Manchuria that's going on right now?
Right. Well, I think a good issue to sort of signpost the discussion is you had just weeks ago China unveil a monument to commemorate the Korean National Liberation Army. It was a small black sort of top, as they would call them in Korean, like a rock slab that so is there to remember the great struggle against Japanese influence, against Japanese colonization in the region by the Korean National Liberation Army. Manchuria is like your quintessential liminal space because there was so much going on there in the last 100 years. A lot of confluence of different cultures, nation states, peoples, etc. And it's sort of been appropriated by the various historiographies of the countries and the regions as that place wherein everything was made in the last 100 years. If you'll permit me to make such a grandiose statement. And right now you see China and South Korea sort of cooperating on their understanding of history, mainly history that took place in that region, to basically bash Japan. So you have very adroitly these statements of appropriating history for political purposes. And I think that is one of the, to use a very recent example, so Xi Jinping comes to Seoul and he reminds, as if they needed to be reminded, of Japanese heinous crimes committed during World War II against both Chinese and South Korean peoples. And I think that's an example of like the use of Manchuria as a historical space for like contemporary political purposes. In fact, when we were in Jilin province, the three of us, we went to the new the Goguryeo National Museum. Just a few side comments that are kind of interesting that may be telling of something or maybe not. I'm not sure. They're quite restrictive about what you can and can't bring in. They don't allow you to bring in any book bags. You certainly can't bring in any cameras, and thus you can't take any pictures. Because you have this, like, and you've had for the better part really in the last 20 years, but for the better part of the last century, this great debate amongst historians in the field of historiography about how do we write history and how do we reproduce it for the nation state? But anyway, so you walk into the museum and what the first thing that confronts you is this huge piece of glass upon which there's a long inscription that talks about, gives you a brief history of the region. And it specifically mentions Goguryeo. Goguryeo was one of the ancient kingdoms during the Three Kingdom period. And it's often claimed by South Koreans to be like the predecessor to what is now Korea. South Korea, North Korea, could be either one, but Korea as it's understood, broadly speaking. That's their interpretation of like the linear development of the nation state. So of course, Goguryeo was Korea, and Goguryeoans were Koreans, one and the same. But the Chinese side, the Chinese perspective, what's sort of presented to you in this story is that Goguryeo was like a band of barbarians who were subdued and then willingly submitted to the rightful rule of the Chinese emperor, and so like they sort of subjugate Korea to its status as a vassal, of the Chinese empire that submitted rights and kowtowed and all that kind of stuff that is expected of one who's a vassal. So you can see in that the interplay of dialogues, or the interplay of narratives, sort of these historical issues born out today.
Right, and that's interesting because it contradicts kind of the historical cooperation between the cooperation and historical research between South Korea and China on their kind of the World War II narrative, right? Because here we see South Korea and China in opposition to this narrative. And, I mean, we haven't even gotten to South Korea and China's differing narratives on the origins of the Korean War. I mean, the Chinese textbooks still suggest that the United States and South Korea are mostly to blame for causing the Korean War. So can we suggest that perhaps this warming of relations between Beijing and Seoul is on the narrative of the anti-Japan struggle during the 30s and 40s is kind of like a short-term and short-sighted vision?
Absolutely. And I think you didn't point it out, but I'll go ahead and point it out myself. Like, if you didn't notice in the retelling of my story that there was a contradiction there. It's like, well, okay, so China and South Korea agree right now that the anti-Japanese struggle sort of unites them ideationally against Japan and unites mm-hmm. these people across, you know, across the two, you know, across boundaries. But you have this much more deep-seated, more historical, if you will, it reaches back further into history debate about, you know, the pre-Manchuria, the Goguryeo area, we'll call it. But it's like they're willing temporarily to overlook that issue, to, as I said earlier, sort of bash Japan. And the common theme there is an anti-Japanese struggle. So to struggle against Japan is to be patriotic. And that's something that sort of transcends the borders of South Korea and China and unites sort of disparate forces in the region.
Hmm. And certainly there's more to this than just the international relations aspect to it. You wrote recently about the whole scandal over the prime minister nominee, Moon Chang-guk in South Korea, and his use of the historical narrative to establish political legitimacy during the nomination process. Could you perhaps briefly describe that story and discuss what that event shows us about the use of historical narratives in South Korea?
Sure.
Like in the domestic politics.
Right. Yes. In the domestic context, absolutely. I don't think it mainly stayed domestic. It was another controversy amongst controversies when it comes to nominating people for cabinet positions in Park Geun-hye's administration, which has been sort of a thorn in her side. This time around, they nominated another old guy. And this fellow was particularly controversial because he had allegedly, and I think it was 2010, made remarks at one of his local churches that the division of the peninsula was the division of the peninsula in the Korean War was God's will, and that's problematic for a lot of people on a lot of levels. So we won't get into why, but we'll get into sort of the backlash and the response. So that, in addition to some other remarks he had made, which were perceived by leftist politicians and a lot of society as being pro-Japanese, he was seen as another one of these like collaborator type figures. And to be like pro-Japanese in South Korea is like being anti-Israel in the U.S. Like it's a death knell to your political career usually. But he stuck it out. Moon Jung-guk stuck it out for a while. And we covered this at Sino NK a bit in a number of our Shigoks, and you can go back and read those at the website, sinonk.com. But, to recap very briefly, he basically stuck it out for a bit. And it was interesting at one point in his sort of struggle with the media, in a conference in the morning, he goes very frustrated and he said, look, my grandfather was an anti-Japanese liberation fighter. Was a liberation fighter, an anti-Japanese a partisan, and I strive to be most like An Jung-gun. And An Jung-gun, as some people may know, was an independence fighter who assassinated Ito Hirobumi at Harbin train station in 1909. Has sort of been idolized in the grand narrative in South Korea as like. That person who sort of kickstarted or executed what they called the patriotic deed, and is sort of is again idolized as this great patriotic martyr. So he wants to paint himself in that sort of light. He wants to sort of extol himself as someone who's clean, pristine, and a great patriot. So to do that, you say, well, I want to be like people who struggled against the Japanese. Specifically, I want to be like that guy who assassinated. Ito Hirobumi, who was the first prime minister of Japan. So that's like really rubbing in and really emphasizing, underlining his anti-Japanese credentials.
Right, right. So, I mean, granted, in this particular case, even with his, I guess, anti-Japan credentials, Moon was not nominated, or he didn't pass through the nomination process to finally become prime minister. But nonetheless, clearly, as we've seen in South Korea's refusal to accept the information sharing agreement, clearly, like, here, the historical narrative within the domestic politics of South Korea still carries huge capital, political capital, as kind of establishing political legitimacy. Would you suggest that that's correct?
Yeah, definitely. To establish legitimacy to use as sort of ammo in a political battle. I think Moon was sort of a lost cause by the time he had sort of made this assertion. He was carrying too heavy of baggage, and people just did not want him. The administration did not want him. He was far too divisive, and someone like that is probably not going to make it through the nomination process, so they're dropped. But it doesn't, it doesn't suggest that that was a bad idea for him to do that, because it is a way to sort of appropriate certain amount of political capital that can be used for the benefit of a politician in a, you know, locked in a domestic struggle.
Right. And we have this case where politicians are using the anti-Japan rhetoric as a means to establish political legitimacy. We have the government not pushing through foreign policy measures because of public opposition to South Korea's warming relations with Japan. And we have this idea that, but at the same time, we have this idea that, we have the situation where South Korea is still pursuing this anti-Japan narrative, despite the fact that, vis-a-vis China, despite the fact that this is a very short-sighted plan, given that China and South Korea also differ on many historical narratives. So, would you suggest that Seoul right now is pursuing a very short-sighted foreign policy that's ultimately contrary to Seoul's national interest, to South Korea's national interest?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not quite sure how to answer that one. I think, like, the appropriation of certain ideational issues for political gain is a strategy that politicians and state leaders who need to accumulate political capital, because they need it, like Park Geun-hye, who quite needs it right now, who's being called a lame duck already, they're going to do that. But I think perhaps the maybe a bigger question that I will provide an answer to, that I think is worthy of anyone sort of considering, is what is, like, regionally, because it's not just South Korea who's using, like, the historical stick to beat neighbors, it's everyone in the region. Right. And The Economist had a really good article, I think last week, about, like, the textbook wars. So you can see this borne out, this manifests itself in the writing of textbooks and, like, the textbook wars that are going on in the respective countries in Northeast Asia. And it makes you sort of wonder, like, at what point will this spill over into actual conflict? Or could it spill over into actual conflict? And I think that's kind of what the question started with, like, how much impact on, like, the decision-making process amongst those who matter can these ideational issues have? And is Northeast Asia's, as a collection of countries, inability to sort of reconcile its contentious past sort of leading it to, you know, people like to compare it to Europe just prior to World War I? And it's like Northeast Asia sort of approaching that sort of tipping point. I don't know. It's hard to say, right? Because it's clearly in no one's interest to do something silly like start a war or even a localized conflict, because you don't want people dying. That's bad for any politician. So is it short, to go back to just to South Korea, to answer that question, which should answer it for them all, is it short-sighted? I mean, yeah, it's a bad idea. It's not a sustainable strategy, because it's not going to help towards reconciliation, because what the region needs is for basically, everyone in the region, specifically China, South Korea, Japan, and North Korea, of course, to sort of get over the past and get on with it. But that doesn't seem to be happening. And if we can if I were to grant that ideational issues did have some impact on like broader, you know, strategic planning, then we would say, yes, this is very short-sighted. This is potentially explosive, and that's bad, and we don't want that.
I mean, certainly something that Washington doesn't want in the context of their pivot to East Asia, because Washington really wants Japan and South Korea to cooperate. I mean, one of the big reasons for Obama kind of tolerating or accepting, kind of actually insofar as supporting the reinterpretation of Article 9 was that it would reduce the American troop burden, the security burden that the United States has in Northeast Asia. And yet this seems to have kind of caught Washington aware in the fact that now that because Japan has greater freedom to operate its self-defense force, South Korea is offended and is using this historical narrative to kind of unsettle this traditional alliance structure. And overall, I mean, like, I was reading earlier about how South Korea currently, because of the demographic factors, is reducing their troop levels. Like, they just simply don't have enough conscripts to place, you know, the number of required troops on the border. And one of the solutions that Elizabeth Stephen from the East-West Center proposed in 2011 was that, well, if South Korea can just have more effective cooperation with Japan and the United States, then you can more efficiently utilize these troops without increasing the troop levels. In fact, you can decrease the troop levels in South Korea and still use those forces, the remaining forces, to effectively deter North Korea and provide whatever defenses you need. And this seems like something that South Korea would really want. This is like, you know, objective national interest is, you know, they have this demographic situation they can't really reverse. So they need to cooperate with Japan. And yet this historical narrative seems to be in the way of actually achieving that national interest.
Maybe, so let me press you on something. So I guess the juxtaposition that's been established in our conversations is like the explanatory power of ideas versus the explanatory power of like sort of more objective structural conditions, mm-hmm. like the distribution of power within the region, the structure of foreign trade, that sort of thing. And right. when we're talking about sort of South Korea rebalancing, like, you know, does it share military information and cooperate more with Japan? Like, does it do this? Well, I mean, we have to ask ourselves, why would it want to do this? And from a U.S. perspective, it's, of course, the balance against China. But is that in South Korea's strategic interest to do so? I would say probably not. Like, South Korea's number one trading partner is Japan, is China, right?
Right, right.
And I say, you know, if the structure of foreign trade is going to help us to understand, like, the orientation, the, you know, the foreign policy a path that a country takes, then therein lies the explanation that because South Korea has to walk this tightrope, because it's a so-called trip amongst whales, that it can't just simply throw its lot in with Japan and say, yeah, we're going to go ahead and balance against China. But I don't think the ideas or history has much of anything to do with that. It's simply that, like, South Korea has to be careful about what it does because it doesn't want to make China upset. It doesn't want to make China mad. So there we have.
I mean, that's certainly.
Go ahead.
I mean, so sorry. I mean, but that's certainly true. But, like, South Korea doesn't. I mean, when South Korea does anything militarily, it's not to deter China. It's to deter North Korea, and China fully understands that, don't they? I mean, with the issue with the troop levels, that's not to deter Chinese aggression against South Korea. It's to deter North Korean aggression towards South Korea, right?
Yeah.
So Seoul does not take the threat from North Korea lightly either. This is within their objective national interest to ensure that their troops are effective in their defensive posture towards North Korea. I mean, we have continuous missile provocations from North Korea. We have continuous clashes between South and North Korean navies and along the northern limitation line. So clearly in this situation, it is within South Korea's best national interest to cooperate with Japan and the United States to more effectively deter North Korea, given that the current South Korean demographic conditions doesn't allow South Korea to sustain the same kind of troop levels it has.
Right. So that's why Xi Jinping's trip to Seoul is even more important, because he proves to them, so it's a confidence building measure, right? To show to South Korea that, you know, we see you there. We know North Korea is a thorn in your side, just like it's a thorn in our side. And although we're not going to abandon our brother there, if they're in alliance or not, who knows? But it's to ensure sort of South Korea that, you know, there's recognition that there are two Koreas, that they have problems, and that China plays a large role in sort of adjudicating and controlling that problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, we'll get to more on the ramifications of Xi Jinping's visit vis-a-vis North Korea, but I think one thing that we do need to mention is the acceleration of the free trade agreements between Korea and China. And you mentioned something very interesting in our earlier discussion, before this, the recording of this video, about what a special, privilege that Korea will have if they, establish this free trade agreement with China. Could you, elaborate on that? Do you remember our conversation about,
Yeah, I do. I think they already have a sort of special position in the world as the only country that has concluded FTAs with the world's two largest economies. If to account the EU as an economy in and of itself, which I think is fair, and the United States, so they've already achieved that, and it's basically a part of Korea's sort of grand foreign policy scheme plan, if you can say they have one, a grand plan. But if to conclude one with China, then they would have one with the world's three largest economies. And I think that's something to take note of. And I know when I brought that up, then you got into, you responded with a comment about, South Korea's highly centralized, decision-making process, which permits it to do this, and which is one structural explanation for why Japan has such a hard time doing this, because it has to go through so many levels of bureaucracy that it takes infinitely longer for them to conclude an FTA. And there's so many more provisions that have to be added in Japan than in South Korea, who can basically go from one government to another and say, we're ready to conclude an FTA. If our populace starts to protest against this, we'll do it anyway. And when you have, when you have both sides of the political aisle who basically buy into that sort of vision, into that sort of strategy, which you do in South Korea, you have like the structural conditions necessary to conduct the sort of foreign policy strategy that Seoul seems to be conducting. And I think, you know, that's interesting on a lot of levels.
Right. And the other aspect of this that I find very interesting is the fact that in 2012, then Prime Minister of Japan, Noda, met with his counterparts from South Korea at the time, Lee Myung-bak and forgot who represented China, but the three leaders met and they agreed that they would forward a trilateral free trade agreement. But at the time, President Lee Myung-bak of South Korea said that he doesn't want to set a time frame. Like, he doesn't want to set a specific time frame for when this negotiation should start or when the preliminary policy should be forwarded and anything like that. And it seems to me like the reason why President Lee Myung-bak didn't want to do that, because there were a lot of voices in South Korea that were suggesting that the free trade agreement would be way more effective for South Korea if South Korean firms don't have to compete with Japanese firms in China. So President Lee delays further negotiations on the trilateral free trade agreement and kind of waited until there was reason for China and South Korea to go ahead without Japan in the free trade agreement. And it seems like, again, here, the ideational aspect, this historical narrative of anti-Japan narrative has played a role as a vehicle for allowing South Korea to push ahead, leave Japan behind, and simply pursue its objective national interests. Would you agree with that view?
Probably not. There might be something like that, but I doubt it. And here's why. You think about who, like, South Korea is an export-oriented economy. So growth is dependent upon exports from its, you know, 10 to 12 largest conglomerates. And then you think who those conglomerates are, what they're exporting, who they're competing with. Let's take, for example, Samsung, who's, you know, makes great televisions, flat screen TVs, and computer monitors. They are most certainly competing with Sony. They're competing with, you know, Lenovo, the company in Taiwan. But think of a Chinese manufacturer of that stature who's competing with Samsung. I can't. Because I don't, like, if you, to introduce sort of a temporal component to this consideration, you got to think about where these three economies are along the developmental path. And Japan and South Korea are certainly advanced industrial economies. China's not. China's still technically a developing country. So it's safe for South Korea to conduct an FTA with China. One more point I want to make. We're throwing this label free trade agreement, FTA, around a lot. But it's kind of misleading, right? Because each free trade agreement is unique in its own way. It's very different. It's a meticulous negotiating process between two countries to see what will be exempted, what will be phased in, and what will be excluded. So it's probably more like a strategic trading agreement. And I think that might be what Japan actually calls them. It's something like that. I think someone needs to look this up, but it's something like strategic trading agreement because
rice is always left out.
Yes, right? Rice, and then there's all sorts of other industries. And you have to take into account like the domestic political scene, how powerful labor unions are, if they're powerful at all, that sort of thing. So I think all these things have to be taken into consideration. But it's like the structure of foreign trade, I think, is basically what we're talking about. With considerations for the domestic scene, it goes a great deal in explaining why countries are pursuing the foreign policy strategies they are.
Right. I mean, but going back to what I suggested earlier, I mean, this is exactly why South Korea doesn't want a trilateral free trade agreement with Japan, right? Because if there is a trilateral free trade agreement or strategic trade agreement, whatever the nuance is, Korean companies will have to compete with Japanese companies in the Chinese market. And if you don't have the same kind of trade relations with Japan, if China doesn't have the same kind of trade relations with Japan than with South Korea, then South Korean firms will benefit from that, wouldn't they?
Yes.
I mean, so here is where I'm suggesting that perhaps the Lee Myung-bak administration didn't want a trilateral free trade agreement in the first place and kind of delayed the process until there was enough political justification, enough diplomatic capital for Seoul to step forth and say, we don't want a trilateral free trade agreement because I don't like Tokyo's attitude. And this seems to me like this is what happened during Xi Jinping's recent state visit to Seoul, where President Park Geun-hye can say, well, surely you don't want to establish a trilateral free trade agreement when Tokyo is behaving so badly in terms of their historical narrative, their attitudes towards all their war crimes during the Second World War, reestablishing the deployable capacity of the Self-Defense Force. And this is the mechanism that I'm talking about, this kind of utilizing the historical narrative to justify certain national interests that South Korea has.
Okay, yeah, I can buy that. So it's sort of the dressing on, the strategic cake. Like, it sounds good, and it particularly sounds good to a populace who is sort of predisposed to already view another country in, a negative light. South Koreans to Japanese, South Korea to Japan.
Right. Now, just speaking more on the Xi Jinping visit to South Korea, there were a lot of articles when this visit occurred that this represents some kind of a warming relationship between South Korea and China, and that this directly reflects a drift in the relationship between Pyongyang and Beijing. Would you suggest that this is, how would you assess that argument? That because Xi Jinping has visited Seoul, and because no Chinese leader has made the same kind of posture or gesture towards the North Korean leadership, that this certainly means that China is, kind of signaling that they're abandoning North Korea.
Yeah, I think the buzzword that's been flying around the interwebs is snub, right? Xi's decision to snub Pyongyang. And I think it's ungrounded. It's funny. I actually have an article up right here I want to read a quote from. The author doesn't need to be mentioned because this is sort of the narrative that's being pushed around And the quote goes like this. The Chinese government's irritation at its longtime ally has been building for some time, and Xi's decision to snub Pyongyang by not even bothering to visit the North Korean capital before or after his trip to Seoul demonstrated that the annoyance has reached new heights. End quote. I don't understand how that conclusion can be made based upon this. That's a really bold conclusion on very limited information. I think that so we have not a lot of, the sample size is quite small. So we have three leaders who have reigned over North Korea, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kim Il-sung is sort of like an exception. It was a different time. It was a different place. So let's rule him out. So we have another sample to look at. That was of Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il. And if you look at him, you see that it took 6 years from the point of his inauguration, of his ascension to the throne in 1994, to 2000 when he visited Beijing, and a year after which the visit was reciprocated by a Chinese delegation. So you're talking 7-year period. So it took 6 years for a North Korean leader to go to China, which is how it's going to be. You're not going to have a Chinese leader going to North Korea first. It's going to be because we understand how, like, the region has been ordered for the better part of 500 years. That lesser country is going to send a delegation first, and then the visit will be reciprocated, right? So Kim Jong-un hasn't been around that long, and he's certainly, at this time, not going to be making a trip to China. So, of course, they're not going to send someone. Xi Jinping's not going to go to North Korea first. But I think even going back to, you know, small sample size and making bold conclusions, we only really have one other example, one other leader of North Korea to look at it, to compare to the current one. And that's not enough information to make any strong conclusions. But it suggests that this is certainly not a snub.
Right.
And it indicates basically nothing, I think.
Right. I mean, and just looking back on North Korean history, I mean, this isn't new, right? I mean, Kim Il-sung has repeatedly invited successive Soviet leaders to visit Pyongyang, and none of them have. And despite all that, the Soviet aid and assistance to North Korea never really ebbed. I mean, in part because it was the Cold War condition. I mean, the Soviet Union wasn't gonna just get up and recognize South Korea, but, I mean, not until the very end when, you know, towards the end of the Soviet Union. But, this isn't new in North Korean history, and therefore, the Pyongyang leadership probably isn't looking at this as a snub from the Chinese leadership, right?
Right. It's very difficult to know because we can't call them up and ask them.
Right.
So we were talking about this before. This sort of situations often lead to what some people call navel gazing. And in the absence of information, we're just going to stare and ponder at the possibilities and then opine endlessly. And what you end up with is like the conclusions, which I basically just, similar to what I just read. Did Pyongyang view this as a snub? Well, there's nothing that indicates they thought so. We might, if they really did, we might see something coming out of the, you know, the official organs, the state-run newspapers, but we don't see anything there. And they haven't made it known that, that they're upset at China for visiting South Korea and not North Korea. And I think this sort of practice really ought to be avoided. I know that my advice will certainly not be heeded because there's interest in North Korea and thus demand for information, even where information doesn't exist. So we're going to get plenty more navel gazing and a lot of guesswork. So that's my general rant critique of that. But just sort of to emphasize that, you know, Xi Jinping's visit to Seoul, in regards to North Korea and its relationship with China, doesn't really tell us anything. You know, they're not going to cut off, despite what Yonhap might report, they're not going to cut off the flow of oil from China to North Korea. That's going to keep on coming. And they're not going to make moves to facilitate the collapse of the regime. Nothing like that.
Right. I mean,
go ahead.
I mean, even in the joint statements, I mean, Xi Jinping and Beijing has certainly sustained its position that they support a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula, but they haven't gone so far as to suggest that this should be a Seoul-led unification on the Korean Peninsula, correct?
Statements made to the effect of, like, changing significantly, like, official positions.
Right.
It was a lot of parade and pomp, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, except for the FTA, I mean, that's certainly the big achievement of that trip. But in terms of North Korea policy, seems like there has been very little done. You mentioned navel gazing, and because you did, I'm kind of hesitant to pose this question now, but would you suggest that, I mean, there's been also talks that because Seoul and Beijing are getting, you know, they're warming their relationship, they're cooperating more economically, they're cooperating more politically and diplomatically, that that Pyongyang is looking to counterbalance this growing relationship by reaching out to first Russia with its economic deals, and now with Japan with the deal to, if there was a deal established earlier this year that if North Korea cooperates with Japan and looking for survivors of the kidnappings of Japanese civilians during the Cold War, then kidnapped Japanese civilians were brought to North Korea during the 70s and 80s, that Japan will abolish some of the sanctions that's imposed on North Korea. Do you see this? Would you suggest that this assessment that Pyongyang is looking to Russia and Tokyo to counterbalance the warming relationship between South Korea and China? I mean, is that a valid argument? I'm guessing that based on your earlier suggestions that you're not quite convinced of this assessment.
Well, no, I mean, that's a very basic assessment, right? There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, middle and weaker powers are often seeking balancing strategies. That's what Pyongyang's doing. It's what it's always done. But it's not just what Pyongyang has always done. It's what states always do, like these sorts of states do. I mean, that's where I'm not a big fan of IR, but, you know, it's had some breakthroughs here and there. And it's good at providing us with, like, very parsimonious theory that explains state behavior in an international system. And that's one thing that wherein IR could help us to understand something is, like, a situation like this, wherein if policymakers, strategists in Pyongyang feel as if a China and Seoul's relationship is warming, of course they're going to seek to balance that because they don't want to find themselves in a disadvantageous position.
Right. Just to, I guess, in terms of, in lieu of a conclusion, as people, as analysts in North America who are looking at, I guess, U.S. policy in East Asia, looking at the, I guess, the current conditions and current relations between Japan, South Korea, North Korea, and China, what would you suggest that, I mean, do you have any policy suggestions for Washington in terms of how to more effectively deal with the conflict that exists in terms of the historical narrative and the hurt feelings between South Korea and Japan?
Mm-hmm. That's a tall order.
I mean, it is a tall order.
Generally speaking, if I had the ear of a senior policymaker in Washington and he were willing to listen to me, I would give him advice regarding South Korea because that's a country I know best. And I would tell him to be wary of like Seoul's delicate position within, you know, a sort of volatile web of, relations at the moment. And like, you don't want to push Seoul into a position where it has to act in such a way that could potentially, offend Beijing because it can't do that. Nor do you want to do something that would incentivize or push Seoul into doing something that would further offend Tokyo. Because if we have, if we have a naval battle over Tokyo, that's bad for everyone in the region, including the United States. That's a very extreme example. That's most likely not going to happen. Almost certainly not going to happen, but we're speaking of hypotheticals anyway. Mm-hmm. I think that would be the sort of general advice I would take. And just to be mindful that ideas and history is much more volatile in this part of the world than it is perhaps in the United States. It's volatile and important in the United States as well. Historiography is big everywhere. It's big in the area of the nation state, but one just needs to be particularly mindful of the sensitive historical issues in Northeast Asia and how it could potentially lead to a diplomatic embroil that would be best avoided.
Right. Well, I think that's very good advice. thank you very much for speaking with me today and speaking with us today.
Yeah.
I think this was a very productive and informative conversation that gives us a better understanding of the current situation in Northeast Asia. Thank you so much.